All right, let's go ahead and get started. Steve Lamb, alcoholic. And before we get into the next session, which will be about inventory, I've got some people that are have volunteered for amends. I appreciate that, gentlemen. Also behind me, Rick has been nice enough to put this. It's not a basket; it's a green kind of Tupperware bowl. But there's some sheets of paper that you can write your questions on and put them in there. And in the afternoon session, that's what we'll do. Also, a number of you have asked me about some of the materials that I'm reading and some of the letters and things like that. I don't have any pride of ownership to any of that stuff because, frankly, I didn't write any of it. Okay, it's just cobbled off of a bunch of different sources. So I'll be happy if anybody wants this stuff to email it to him. And I think that Rick has also volunteered that I can send it to him, and I think he might put some of it up on the website. But my email address is really, really easy. It's steve.lamb, L-A-M-B, at live, L-I-V-E.com. And I'll write it down and have it up here on the table. But just, you know, email me and I can get anything you want to you. Also, my phone number is 323-252-4663. I'll put that up here on the table so you got it on a separate sheet of paper if you want to call me about anything. In that regard, in addition to the materials, one of the things that I started doing a long time ago is I'm kind of anal retentive. So when I would do my meditation in the morning, my daily practice is to read a number of dailies, meditation dailies. And then I would take the ones that I either understood or didn't understood or liked or didn't like and wanted to review again. And I'd put little snippets of them and I'd write them out. And then I would later, again, because I'm almost, you know, I don't know what the deal is, but I just have a hard time focusing sometimes. I would read it again without the whole text, so just the ones that I'm interested in. And when I started working with a lot of guys that were having problems with meditation, they were aware that I did that, and they asked me to circulate that. And for a number of years now, I do a daily email that has daily readings. I'll tell you the sources if you're interested, but it's everything from, you know, the Bible, to the Quran, to the Upanishads, to the Bhagavad Gita, to a number of things that you guys are familiar with, the 24-hour-a-day book, you know, as Bill sees it. It's not linked to anything or any type of particular religion. It's all just spiritual stuff that may or may not pique your interest. And if any of you want to be on that list, you just email me and I'll put you on that list too, okay? But right now we're going to talk about inventory. So, you know, we've gone through, we've done steps 1 through 3. You know, we've admitted we're powerless over alcohol. Our lives are unmanageable. You know, there's some power greater than ourselves that's supposed to restore us to sanity. I'm skeptical, but I will agree that it's possible. Apparently that's enough. That's what the book says. I'm willing to turn my will and my life over to this thing that I don't completely understand or agree with or have contact with at this stage. But I really don't have a choice. And I'm willing to go ahead and do this, and apparently the first indication of doing that is inventory. The inventory you'll see on pages 63 through 71 of the big book. 63 through 67 is resentment, 67 through 68 is fear, 69 through 71 is sexual misconduct. And then it kind of loops back into that in the 10th step on pages 84 and 85. But why do we do it? I mean, why do we do inventory? You know, in the big book, it talks about how it works. It doesn't say why it works. And I don't know that they'll ever have anything about why it works. But why do we do it? Well, we do it to recover. That's why we do it. I mean, there's no requirement to do it. But if you want to recover, that's what's suggested. So what is when we talk about recovery, what do we mean? To recover is to regain health after sickness, to grow well again, to recover from an illness. Recovery is the act or power of recovering. It's restoring from sickness. Now, in some areas of the country, there's a huge hot debate on whether I'm a recovered alcoholic or a recovering alcoholic. I will tell you that I don't think it's useful to get into those semantic gymnastics. It's more important that you do the work, at least from my perspective. But I will tell you that the word recovering appears only once in the big book. And recovered appears a number of times. The only time recovering appears is on page 122. And it's in the chapter to wives. It's, our women folk have suggested certain attitudes a wife may take with a husband who is recovering. The implication there being that he hasn't gone through the steps yet. That he is in the process of taking the steps, that he's in the process of recovering. However, the word recovered appears numerous times in the big book in relation to describing an alcoholic who has undergone a psychic change, who has recovered from Alcoholics Anonymous, who has recovered from alcoholism, not from Alcoholics Anonymous. So in the forward, yeah, I don't know. We don't ever, I don't think we ever recover from Alcoholics Anonymous, yeah. It's a fatal malady that one can never overcome. The foreword to the first edition says, "We who have recovered." Page 17 says, "Nearly all have recovered." Page 20, "We have recovered." Page 29, "Clear-cut directions are given showing how we recovered." Page 90, "You as a person who has recovered." And this is talking to the person who is going to sponsor the person. So you as a person who has recovered can convey this message to the person who is recovering. Page 132, "We who have recovered." Page 133, again, "We who have recovered." So how does one recover? How does one have the essential psychic change that's referred to in the doctor's opinion on Roman numeral 29? How do you get the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism that it talks about in Appendix 2, Spirituality? How do you get a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening that's referenced in Appendix 2 and on pages 25 and 60? And is there a difference? You know, when we went from the original manuscript and the first edition to the second edition, it became a spiritual awakening rather than a spiritual experience. And it seems to me that one of the reasons why we did that is because we didn't want it to make it look like it had to be this sudden, impulsive, white light experience that Bill had. Because not everybody has that. In fact, I think very few people have that. And indeed, a lot of times when we have a spiritual experience, we are not aware that we've had a spiritual experience until we later look back and see how we live and move and have our being in the world differently than we did before based on the spiritual experience that we had. And frequently, what happens is a friend or a sponsor will talk about it and they'll bring it to light. I remember I used to talk to my sponsor about obsessing about wanting to drink for months. I mean, I wanted to drink bad. And we had a conversation at one point in time, I think it was 6, 7, 8 months into it, and he said, "Hey, Lamb, you didn't mention drinking. You haven't mentioned drinking all week." I'm like, "Oh, yeah." He goes, "Well, when did that stop?" I don't know. I'm not sure. I didn't get a white light thing. It just stopped. I think it somewhere was between 7 and 8, step 7 and 8, but I'm not entirely sure. And that's how a lot of people have these types of spiritual awakenings or spiritual experiences, okay? And most of us, sometimes it happens suddenly. If you read Varieties of Religious Experience, there are people that hit bottom so hard and they're just struck sober. You know, they have what they believe is an experience with the God of their understanding and boom, they're sober. Now Bill, I will tell you, Bill had that experience in 1934 in December. In Towns Hospital. But does the experience sustain us? If it did, why in May of 1935 was he pacing back in the hotel lobby of the Mayflower Hotel thinking about drinking and desperately needing to call another drunk, so he didn't drink? You know, the experience is great, but it doesn't necessarily sustain us. And one of the things that's so interesting about the concept of a spiritual awakening, and we'll talk about it more Sunday, is my experience is we awaken and then we go back to sleep. Because it's more comfortable being asleep. It's more comfortable not being present and aware of what's going on. And that's what happens when you drink. You get to that euphoric state where, hey man, whatever. It's all good. And that's something that gets out of being right here and right now. So how do we recover? Is it the steps or is it meetings? Something for you guys to consider. There's very few references to meetings in the big book. On pages 159 through 160, there's a reference to, quote, casual get-togethers, end quote, in homes. And it became customary to set apart one night a week for a meeting to be attended by anyone or everyone interested in a spiritual way of life. One meeting a week. One meeting a week. There's no general sharing or participation meetings back then. We didn't do that. They had what they called house parties, which would be viewed more like a speaker meeting, more synonymous with a speaker meeting now. That goes on until 1975. We get the forewords to the third and the fourth edition, and there's a shift from hopelessness and desperation in the first 164 pages to experience strength and hope. Everybody who's been around for any period of time has gone to a speaker meeting when they say, Jimmy's going to get up and share his experience, strength, and hope. Jerry's going to give his experience, strength, and hope. It's not that they don't have experience, strength, and hope, but that phrase didn't come into being in Alcoholics Anonymous until 1975 in the third edition. If you look at the first 164 pages, it talks about hopelessness, desperation. Why is that important? Because as Harry Thiebaud said, that's the hitting bottom. That's what makes us malleable. That's what makes us teachable. Because until we're beaten into a state of submission, we may comply, but we will never, ever, ever surrender. We won't do it. We won't do it. In the forward to the fourth edition, it says, in any meeting anywhere, AA share experience, strength, and hope with each other in order to stay sober and help other alcoholics. Third edition is every day somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks with another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. Those are all true. But what seems to have happened in some areas of the country is that Alcoholics Anonymous has become more meeting-centric than step-centric. Okay, and one of the things that happened when we no longer utilized what was believed to be copyrighted with the circle and the triangle with unity, recovery, you know, those three triangles, okay, unity, recovery, and service, is that there was less of a focus on one and more a focus on the other. And most of us have gone to a meeting where an alcoholic has gotten up and they're having a rough spell and they say, you know, I'm gonna ramp up my program. I'm going to get to it. I'm going to stop going to two meetings a week. I'm going to go to four meetings a week. I've never heard, except in a men's stag like yours, anyone talk about that and say, I'm going to ramp up my program. I'm going to do a 10th step. I'm going to do a 5th step. I've never heard that at a regular meeting. It's about meetings. And again, I'm not here to judge or criticize. There are people that seem to do fine that way. They don't ask me to sponsor them. You know, I get it. They don't need that. And frankly, here's the truth. If I could have just gone to meetings and been okay, I would have done it. I'm not an overachiever. I'm not an extra credit guy. I don't. And when I looked at the steps and I saw, you know, inventory and amends, I thought, whew, I don't want to do that. You know, I did it because I had to do it. So what does the big book say about recovery? It says on page 30, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This was the first step in recovery. The first step is powerless over alcohol. Our life is unmanageable. The program of recovery is referred to on pages 59, 72, and 147. So what's the program of recovery? It's the 12 steps. On page 96, it says the 12 steps of the program of recovery. And when it talks about sponsorship, there's two seminal quotes that talk about recovery. One's on page 94. And it says, and this is what we should do with a new person. Outline the program of action, explaining how you made a self-appraisal, steps 4 and 5, how you straightened out your past, steps 8 and 9, and why you are now endeavoring to be helpful to him, step 12. It is important for him to realize that your attempt to pass this on to him plays a vital part in your own recovery. A vital part in your own recovery. Pages 99 and 100. Remind the prospect that his recovery is not dependent upon people, it is dependent upon his relationship with God. Steps 3, 6, 7, and 11. Okay. So we're talking about inventory. Why should we do inventory? I think one of the best analogies I've ever heard was an analogy given by Chuck Chamberlain. And what he's talking about, and I'm going to bastardize this a little bit and kind of update it to modern tense, but basically you're out on a run. It's been a long time, and you're in the kitchen, and you need a drink of water. I mean, you're parched. You're just desperate for a drink of water. There's nothing around except one funky, dirty water glass. It's sitting on the counter. It's been there for maybe 3 or 4 weeks. You've had gin in it, scotch in it, bourbon, milk on a down day, and you haven't rinsed it out. So it's like green and black and funky, and it's the only glass in your whole apartment. You got to use it. Now, before you can use that glass, you got to clean out some of those chunks. You got to clean out that glass. So you get a fork or a spoon or a knife, and you're rubbing away trying to get the bigger chunks of yourself out of there. That's what we do in 4 and 5. Then once you get the major debris removed, you put it under the tap and you let the water flow. And as the clean water flows in, it takes the remaining residue out. And this takes a while. That's what we do in 8 and 9. And then eventually you've got semi-clear potable water, water that you can drink. And more importantly, not only can you drink it, but you can give it to the new man to drink. Now, the interesting thing about this glass is if you set it on the counter and you don't continue to use it, it accumulates more junk. So you got to clean it out constantly. And that dirty water glass analogy really kind of ties in, at least in my view, with how we talk about the 11th step prayer, where it says, make me a channel. Make me a channel. Now, a channel has to be free from debris and blockage in order to be useful. One of my favorite spiritual teachers is a Sufi mystic who's passed away several centuries ago. His name is Rumi. And he says this, "Your stream water may look clean, but there is unstirred matter on the bottom. Your guide, your sponsor, can dig a side channel that will drain that waste off. Trust your wound to a teacher's surgery. Flies collect on a wound. They cover it. Those flies of your self-protecting feelings, your love for what you think is yours. Let a teacher wave away the flies and put a plaster on your wound. Don't turn your head. Keep looking at the bandaged place. That is where the light enters you. And don't believe for a moment that you are healing yourself." One of the things that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is we get better, but it's not a self-improvement model. It's not. It's more like the island of misfit toys. Okay, and everybody's broken. And how we get repaired is we work on each other. We don't work on ourselves. So when we do inventory, we do it for the purpose of getting ourselves clear and free of this debris and detritus and basic baggage so that we can be helpful. So as the book says, we can be of maximum service to God and to his fellows. But what about the justifiable resentment? There's got to be some stuff that, come on. Seriously? That guy's just a son of a... anybody would be resentful at that, right? Can we afford it? The book tells us that resentment is the number one offender. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. The number one offender. And it's interesting, when I first read the book, I'm like, yeah, it's kind of a bitch, yeah. And then after you've been doing this for a while and you sponsor a few people, you read it and you go, man, resentment is the number one offender. It becomes real. Radcliffe and I were talking about that this morning, how you'll get to sections of the book that you read and maybe you glossed over, and now you're working with somebody and either something's happening to him or something's happening to you that brings that text alive. So what do we do with this? Ricky was asking, I don't know if it was yesterday or this morning, what's a problem? Several years ago before Sandy Beach died, I had a case in Tampa, Florida, so I had the luxury of going out to do this case, and I would do depositions and hearings out there, and I'd spend a few days, and I could get together with Sandy, and we'd go to meetings and do stuff like that, but a lot of times we'd just go to breakfast or lunch. And I'd get to pick his brain about, what it was like in the 60s to go to meetings, because there's no book on that. You got to find an old timer with 45, 50 years to get that information. And one particular morning, I think we were having breakfast. It might have been lunch, but I was complaining about my problem du jour, the problem of the day. And Sandy paused and he looked at me. He says, "You ever have a problem you don't think about?" Now, I got to tell you, I love this guy. I love this guy, and he taught me a lot. But I'm thinking, you know, he's getting old. You know, a problem, you know, really, because I mean, a problem's a problem. Whether I'm thinking about it or not, it's a problem. So, you know, I keep eating for a little while, and then I'm thinking, wait a minute. If I don't think about it, is it really a problem? And the answer is no. You know, one of the things that my sponsor had me do when I started sponsoring people is he had me, when I would then call him with a problem, he would say, you know, I want you to assume that Jerry called you with that problem. What would you tell him? Never mind. Click. You know, because, I mean, here's the reality is when it's happening to you, it's not a problem. You know, it's not a problem for me. It's an issue. Now, I will tell you that there are times, and I've had this situation myself, where your problem becomes my problem. And that's kind of a thin barrier that I think most of us who have sponsored for a while learn to get on the other side of. My grand sponsor, Scott Redman, used to say, be a kind, loving, patient, observer, helper, sponsor. Do not become a psychotic participant. Because we can. You know, I mean, I got enough problems. I don't need your problems, okay? And so the question is then, you know, how do we not think about these problems? And the reality is we get out of self and we get into God. You know, we do this work. We get distracted. One of the things that happens is, you know, the sponsee calls you. Very rarely does he ask you, how are you doing? If he does, he doesn't really care. You know, it's just a segue into his problem. You know, I got to tell you, when I was, last night I talked about I got shot. I'm in Kuya Medical Center, right? I'm in the cardiac intensive care unit. I'm getting calls. I get a call from a guy. He calls me. He goes, hey, how you doing? I said, well, I've had better days. He said, well, what's going on? I said, well, I got shot. He goes, really? Really? Are you okay? I said, yeah, I think I'll be all right. Well, let me tell you what she did yesterday. Now, the book says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problems. No kidding. And the reality is, at first, that used to irritate me. And then I realized, wait a minute. This guy is a divine distraction. Because when I'm thinking about him, I'm not thinking about me. And then what happens, which is really beautiful, is eventually he starts sponsoring guys, and he calls you to talk about Todd. And you have a whole conversation where you don't talk about yourself, and you don't talk about him. You talk about how you're trying to help Todd. But we go through this process and we do inventory. And I mean, I got to tell you, I'll give you an example of one of the things that happened to me is when I, first person that asked me to sponsor him was a woman. I didn't think I had 2 years. But I had gone somewhere and given a talk and you know, apparently it was a pretty good talk. And she was impressed and she asked me to sponsor her. And I thought, okay, I'm supposed to be available to sponsor. She just happened to be attractive. I mean, it was just a coincidence, right? And I was having problems with my wife, some marital discord. I mean, just a coincidence. But I had the foresight to say, well, look, let me get your number and I'll get back to you. So then I go to my sponsor, Michael, and I said, hey, good news, Michael. Somebody asked me to sponsor him. And he said, well, who? Now, I'm a lawyer, so I'm trained to distract. So I just moved on to the next subject. He goes, wait a minute. Who is it? And I told him her name. And he looked at me, and he cocked his head, and he goes, Lamb, you know, I know you have problems with your wife. I know things aren't going that well. But I got to tell you, you know, if you're that hung up with this, you can go over to Torrance Memorial, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and there's an intensive care unit. You go up on the fourth floor and, you know, find one that you think is attractive, kind of unhook her, have your way with her, and then maybe hook her up. Try to hook her up before you leave, you know, because that's basically what you're doing with a newcomer. I thought that was rude, you know. I'm like, I have no intention of doing that. He goes, really? Really? How do you think it would go to listen to her fifth step? Well, I think it'd go fine. He said, would you be inclined to want to record it so you could play it back? I said, well, maybe. I mean, maybe. But, you know, I don't. What does that have to do with it? And he didn't tell me not to sponsor her. But I was not spiritually, mentally, physically prepared to sponsor her. And I told her that. And there's plenty of women. And she was sponsored by this woman. Now, we go forward now 15, 16 years. I'm a man. I sponsor men. I don't sponsor women. Yeah, because that's what I've heard. Men sponsor men, women sponsor women. So I have this woman that asked me to sponsor her because she's having a hard time with other women. And I've worked with women before in certain steps, but I've never sponsored one. And she asked me, and I said, well, I'll talk to my sponsor, but I don't normally do that. So I talked to Michael. I think I'm going to get the same conversation. He says, well, do you find her attractive? I said, no. She seems more of a guy than a lot of the guys that I sponsor. You know, frankly, you know, I got guys who are more of drama queen than she is. She's kind of hard-laced. He said, well, you're not physically attracted to her. No, I said. He says, well, why don't you want a sponsor? And what do you mean? I mean, men sponsor men, women sponsor women. He says, no, but why? Well, I had to get quiet and pray and meditate. The reason why is because I thought people would think badly of me. People would think I'm having sex with her. I'm worried about my reputation. And he says to me, is your reputation more important than her recovery? The answer is no. So I sponsored her. But, you know, that situation changed over time. And she's still more of a guy than a lot of the guys that I sponsor, frankly. You know, and it works out fine. It works out fine. But those are the types of things that happen. And one of the things that I want you to consider is when we do this inventory, within the inventory, we're given the solution for each of these problems. So we can have a problem with a resentment, with fear, or with sexual misconduct. And in every instance, the solution is to turn to God. Now, our foreword says that the purpose of this is to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered. That's the main purpose of this book. And what it says in every instance is to turn to God. So when we have a resentment, what do? On page 67, it says, we asked God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. This is sometimes referred to as the prayer to the sick man. When we are in fear, when self-reliance fails us, what do? On page 68, it says, we trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him. Does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? We let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. What about sexual misconduct? I mean, surely we can handle a little sexual misconduct. We don't really need to bring God into this, do we? Apparently not. On page 69, and if you're new, I'm not kidding, it's on page 69, it says, we ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. So we go through this process of inventory, right? And that's pretty traumatic, you know? It can be. I will tell you that, like I shared last night, my experience, both personally and with the people that I sponsor, is that the more you keep it simple and basic, the better off you'll be. Because people can get hung up. Really, this is just a list. We're just talking about listing different things. Resentments, fear, sexual misconduct. That's all we're doing at this stage. And it takes people a long time sometimes, but it really shouldn't. It should only take a few weeks. And as it says in the big book, the person who's receiving the inventory is going to be prepared for a long talk. So you can do this in bullet points and fill in the blank. Now, if you want to write out your life story, I'll sit there and listen to it, but it's not required. I remember talking to Redmond one time, and he told me that the shortest inventory he'd heard was 22 minutes. The longest he'd heard is 22 hours. Neither one of them stayed sober. The average inventory that I hear is anywhere from 2.5 or 3 hours to 5 or 6 hours. You know, they can be longer, they can be shorter, but that's the average. They take a while. You know, it's a long talk. There's no question that it's a long talk. But it's not nearly as difficult as we make it out to be. And when you get on the other side of that, what happens is you really feel like, some people have spiritual moments, but even if you don't have a spiritual moment, and I really didn't after my fifth step, you'll really feel that you belong in Alcoholics Anonymous, that you've really paid for your seat. But why do we do a fifth step? I mean, you know, I've made a list, And God, whatever he, she, or it is all-seeing and all-knowing. And I mean, why do I need to read it to somebody? Why do I need to bring another person into the equation? You know, like I said last night, part of this is because you need someone to mirror or reflect you off of you. A lot of times we can't see ourselves for ourselves. But this concept of self-examination and confession is really central to all major religions. In Buddhism, there's a story of a guy named Ajahsattu. And Ajahsattu was a young prince who looked around and looked at the kingdom and thought, I'd like to be king now. Well, there's one way to do that. I got to kill mom and dad. So he did. He killed his mom and dad. And because he'd killed his mom and dad, he felt a little guilty. So he decided that he needed to do something about it. So he decided that he was going to find this guy, Siddhartha Gautama, who became what is known as the Buddha. And he's in this middle of this forest at the time, and he's surrounded by his monks and his followers. And he goes up to the Buddha, and he confesses, and he says what he's done. And the Buddha looks at him, and he says, since you have acknowledged the transgression and confessed it is right, we will accept it. For he who acknowledges his transgression as such and confesses it for betterment in future will grow in the noble discipline. You can find this in Judaism. In Numbers 5:7, it says, then they shall confess their sin, which they have done. In Christianity, James 5:16, confess your faults one to another. In Islam, in the Quran, in Ghafir, the forgiver, now we confess our sins. Is there any other way to get out of the fire? The Sufi mystic Rumi that I referred to earlier says, be generous, be grateful, confess when you are not. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. That's what they tell us in the book Alcoholics Anonymous at 87. But what's the origin of this fifth step? How did it get into Alcoholics Anonymous? It appears to have come from the Oxford group. If you look at the foreword to the second edition at Roman numeral 16, it says, though he, meaning Bill Wilson, could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford groups, he was convinced of the need for moral inventory, that's the fourth step. Confession of personality defects, that's the fifth step. Restitution to those harmed, that's the eighth and ninth step. Helpfulness to others, that's the 12th step. And the absolute necessity of belief in and dependence upon God, that's the third and the 11th step. But I mean, why really? I mean, is this really necessary? Do I really have to do this? You know, I came from a background where I had a TSSCI clearance. My office was basically had a cipher lock. There was one person that could go in it, me and me alone. I dealt with classified information my whole life while I was in the Army. And you didn't need to know my business, you know. I just didn't want to do this. I mean, again, we've gone through, we've admitted we're powerless over alcohol, you know, our lives are unmanageable. You know, we've got this belief that something, some power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. We've made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to this, and we've started writing this inventory. We've written this inventory. It's fearless and moral as far as we know. We think it's thorough. We find out later it's not as thorough as we thought it was, but we've listed our resentments, our fears, our sexual misconduct. Now I got to tell someone? Why? Well, the big book on page 72 says the best reason first. If we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. Also on page 72, it says, trying to avoid this humbling experience, they have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Page 73, it says, we must be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live long and happily in this world. The 12 and 12 at 56, it says, few muddled attitudes have caused us more trouble than holding back on step 5. On 57 in the 12 and 12, it says, most of us would declare that without a fearless admission of our defects to another human being, we could not stay sober. It seems plain that the grace of God will not enter to expel our destructive obsessions until we are willing to try this. Well, is this melodramatic? I mean, is this a little bit much, or is this really what goes on? I'll tell you a little personal story. When I got sober, again, I was the guy nobody thought was going to stay sober. I mean, I was the pain in the butt. Nobody liked me. I didn't like anybody. They told me to sit in the corner, not bother anybody. But there were three women that came in with me. And those three women were Sarah, Betsy, and Celeste. And they were just, you know, the belle of the ball. They did everything right. They set up the literature. They did all the commitments. They did everything. They started working the steps. They got a sponsor. I hated Sarah, Celeste, you know, and Betsy. I mean, they were just a pain in the butt. They were the little darlings of the meeting, right? And I was the black sheep. Well, I hit bottom at about 100 days stark, raving, sober. I told you about that last night. I started working the steps. I started working the steps, not believing they would work, but I worked them. You know, I did my utmost to get through them. Every single one of those ladies got some immediate relief. They got to the fifth step, and they're like, yeah, I don't want to do that. And they didn't do that. At about 9 months of sobriety, Betsy came to the Sunday morning meeting. She set up the literature. She gave a little talk. She pulled out the literature. She went up to the Hermosa Hotel, which is right up the road. She checked in, got a bottle of Jack Daniels, fifth of Jack Daniels, drank two fingers of the Jack, hung herself, killed herself. Now, the interesting thing about this, too, is that she didn't die drunk. Most alcoholic suicides are not drunk. They're sober enough to realize they can't drink, but they can't do this. They can't do the program. And they make more out of it than exists. Celeste joined the Navy at about a year and a half. She had never done a fifth step. Last we heard, she was over in Spain. She went absent without leave. Nobody's heard from her. Don't know if she's alive or dead. Sarah was a beautiful woman, absolutely gorgeous. She was a transplant nurse. Her husband, whom she divorced in sobriety, was a transplant surgeon. They had a house on top of the hill. They had horses. She took the house on the beach, on the Esplanade. I mean, they had all kinds of money. She wouldn't do her fifth step. She died in the takeout window at Jack in the Box. She pulled in while she was ordering. She apparently did a little bit too much heroin, and she nodded out, and she died. So is it melodramatic? It doesn't appear to be melodramatic to me. Also on page 56 of the 12 and 12, it says, until we had talked with complete candor of our conflicts and had listened to someone else do the same thing, we still didn't belong. Step 5 was the answer. It was the beginning of our true kinship with God. Now think about that. Until we had talked with complete candor of our conflicts, until I'd given Michael my fifth step, and this is an important and, had listened to someone else do the same thing, we still didn't belong. It's this feeling of separation, this illusion that I talked about last night. Now, Chuck, when he talked about and did the diagram, Chamberlain said there's one problem and one solution. The one problem is conscious separation. The one solution is conscious contact. It's a living problem and it's a living solution. One of the things that I went through when I went through inventory is I had to write about my daughter, Ashley. She was born with cerebral palsy. She had a seizure disorder. And one of the things I'm not proud of is I resented her before I got sober and after I got sober. Why? I don't know. She wasn't normal. I had to take care of her. I had no concept of service. I had no concept of love. I didn't realize that service is the fulfillment of love. I didn't realize that until I grabbed a mop in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you taught me that. But I resent my daughter, I know that a father's not supposed to feel this way about a daughter, you know? And she can't walk, she can't talk. I mean, she's on seizure medication that, you know, she's having these tonic-clonic seizures, you know, anywhere from 10 to 50 to 100 a day. Every 3 or 4 months, she has a massive grand mal seizure. Her heart stops or she stops breathing. They got to paddle her, bring her back. And she's tough. She comes back, but, you know, it's difficult. She's down at this time at the San Diego Children's Hospital. It's a 24-hour care facility right next to it because when she has one of these seizures, she's got to go in right away. And so I worked through this process, you know, and I did inventory. And I prayed and meditated, and I did amends to my daughter. And now I'm back with my daughter, a daughter's restored to a father to a daughter. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. It's great. It's great, right? And I'm thinking, you know, this is good. This is good. But that's not the end of the story. The very first person that I sponsored is a guy named Stephen. Stephen had a son named Evan with cerebral palsy and a seizure disorder, and he resented him in the same way I resented Ashley. We worked these steps, these spiritual exercises, and a son was restored to a father, and a father was restored to a son, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, is that a coincidence? I don't know, and I don't care. Is it a miracle? I don't know. I don't care. It's an experience that I had. I've met a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've met plenty of people that have children that have cerebral palsy with seizure disorders. But the very first person that asked me to sponsor him was that guy. Now, that guy was terribly homophobic. Terribly homophobic. And he doesn't mind that I tell this story, by the way, because it's true and he understands that it helps people. The very first person that asked him to sponsor him, gay guy. Gay guy. You know, the greatest thing about one of the greatest things about Alcoholics Anonymous is whatever your prejudice or bias is, that son of a bitch will walk across the room and ask you to help him. And we will. And then we'll find out that we're not so different. We're not so different. I mean, I was talking, you know, one of my favorite stories in Alcoholics Anonymous is Bill C. was up at, he was in Hollywood. He was giving a talk at a gay and lesbian meeting, and a guy came across the room. He's clearly gay. And he says to Bill, I really like what you talk about. You worked the steps. I was thinking maybe we could talk about, you know, maybe you could sponsor me. And Bill looked at him and said, wouldn't you be more comfortable with a gay sponsor? And the guy looked at him and said, no, I got the gay thing down pretty good. This alcoholism, though, it's kicking my ass. And Bill went, yeah, okay. That's what it's about. It's about the alcoholism. Now, I got to tell you, eventually, we got a call middle of the night, and I had to go down to San Diego. My daughter had a grand mal seizure. She's in the hospital. And I go over, and I brush her hair, and I kiss her, and I tell her I love her, and she's not looking very good, and the doctor calls us over, my wife and I, and he says, I don't know how to tell you this, but, you know, she's not going to make it out this time. I'm like, what are you talking about? My daughter's tough. I mean, we've been through this. I mean, I can't tell you how many times she's been in ICU. And he said, Mr. Lamb, you don't understand. She's 19 years old, but internally she's like 80, 90 years old. The kidneys, the liver can only take so much of these chemicals, these pharmaceuticals, which you would think I would know given the climate of the people that we're dealing with, all the people that need liver transplants and kidney transplants. But I'm arguing with him and I'm bitter. And I, you know, I pray and meditate every morning. I'm having a conversation with God. I'm pissed. I'm like, God, I know I was a crappy father, but I'm a good dad now. How could you do this to me? Because I couldn't see it. And both Michael and Scott encouraged me to continue to pray and meditate. They didn't tell me I was wrong. And what happened in that prayer and meditation is I realized I was being selfish and self-centered. My daughter could never talk, but she could convey her feelings and emotions with her eyes, and she was tired. She was ready to go. And my job was to be her father in this world and the next, and to hold her hand and to be there with her. And I was able to do that through Alcoholics Anonymous. And that happened in 2004, and then a few years ago, the same thing happened with Evan. And we were there for Stephen, and we were there for Evan, and we were there for the family. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the biggest things for me personally that I got out of that is I realized that one of the things that my daughter taught me is about love and service. You know, you guys put the brackets around it, but she put the flesh and bones to it. And that's always going to be with me. And when we talk about pass it on, my view is that's what we pass on, what we've learned. It's not just the book. I mean, anybody can read the book. It's our experience in what we did in the book. And people like Scott Redman and Sandy Beach, and for those of you that have been around a while, Don Pritz, you know, and certainly Clint Hodges. These people are dead, but they are not gone. I talk to you and I hear Clint. I talk to you and I hear Don Pritz. You talk with me and hopefully you hear some of Sandy and you hear some of Scott because it becomes embedded in us. And the religious call it the golden cord, the silver thread, that which binds me to you and you to me and us to God, and which makes no separation. Scott used to call it the connective tissue of Alcoholics Anonymous, the shared spiritual DNA. And I believe that that's what we do when we pass it on. And it's a sacred trust that we all each individually have that we convey through story and through humor, because we can't do it any other way. Time for a break, gentlemen. Thank you.